A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the smoking data in Israel, where youth rates are ticking up despite the global trend heading down. And he's asking whether decades of hard-won public health knowledge have actually translated into lower rates everywhere, or if there are countries and demographics that are bucking the trend. It's a sharper question than it sounds.
It really is, because the headline number looks like a public health victory lap. The WHO's latest data shows global smoking prevalence dropped from 22.7% in 2007 to 17% in 2023. That's roughly 1.3 billion smokers worldwide, down from 1.4 billion in 2000, even with population growth.
Fewer smokers in absolute terms, not just proportionally. That's genuinely impressive.
It is, and it's driven mostly by high-income countries. The UK is down to 12.9% as of 2024. Australia hit 10.1%. Canada's in the same neighborhood. These are places that threw the full toolkit at it. Plain packaging, tax hikes, indoor smoking bans, graphic warnings, cessation programs.
Yet Daniel's looking around Israel and seeing something that doesn't match that victory narrative. What's the actual number here?
Israel's overall smoking rate is 20.3% as of 2024, which is well above the OECD average of 16.5%. But the really concerning piece is youth. The Israel Ministry of Health published data in 2025 showing that smoking among 16 to 18-year-olds rose from 8.2% in 2020 to 9.2% in 2025. That's about a 12% increase over 5 years, while the adult rate was flat to slightly declining.
You've got the global trend heading down, the adult trend in Israel heading down or flat, and youth heading up. That's the paradox Daniel's pointing at.
And it's not just Israel. Parts of Eastern Europe, several Middle Eastern countries, and specific demographics within otherwise declining countries are showing the same pattern. The global average hides enormous variation.
Let's start with the big picture then. What's actually driving the global decline, and why isn't it reaching everyone equally?
The decline is really a story of three mechanisms working together. The first is price. Excise taxes make smoking economically punishing. The second is denormalization. When you can't smoke in bars, restaurants, workplaces, or public transport, the social convenience collapses. And the third is cessation support. Nicotine replacement therapy, counseling, quit lines.
Those three things have been deployed very unevenly globally.
The WHO's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the FCTC, just had its 20th anniversary last year. And while 182 countries are parties to it, implementation varies wildly. The WHO recommends that excise taxes account for at least 75% of the retail price of cigarettes. In Israel, as of 2024, it was around 60%. In some European countries, it's above 80%. In parts of Southeast Asia and Africa, it's below 30%.
Israel did raise taxes recently, didn't they?
They did, a 30% tax hike on cigarettes in 2024, and it did produce about a 5% drop in adult cigarette sales. But here's the kicker, it had virtually no effect on youth water pipe use.
Because water pipe tobacco is taxed differently.
It's taxed much lower, and more importantly, it's barely regulated in terms of age verification and point of sale restrictions. A 16-year-old in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem can walk into a Nargila cafe and order a water pipe with minimal hassle. The enforcement culture around age restrictions is, to put it generously, porous.
Price elasticity works on adults buying packs of cigarettes at the supermarket, but it doesn't touch the social smoking ecosystem that teenagers are actually navigating.
That's exactly the mechanism. And it's not just Israel. Water pipe use is huge across the Middle East and North Africa. The World Bank's 2024 data showed that in Egypt, male smoking rates are still above 50%. In Lebanon, they're around 40%. In Jordan, similar. These are countries where water pipe is deeply culturally embedded, often perceived as less harmful than cigarettes, which is a dangerous misconception. and where the regulatory infrastructure for age enforcement is weak or non-existent.
The perception gap is interesting. Everyone knows cigarettes are deadly, but water pipes somehow escape that branding.
A one-hour water pipe session exposes the user to the smoke volume of roughly 100 cigarettes. The World Health Organization has been saying this for years, but the message hasn't penetrated the way cigarette warnings have. And part of that is because water pipe smoke is cooled through water, which creates the illusion that it's filtered and safer. It's not. It contains the same carcinogens, the same heavy metals, and in many cases higher levels of carbon monoxide.
Part of the Israel paradox is a product-specific knowledge gap. But you mentioned other demographics bucking the trend globally. What's happening with women in lower-income countries?
This is one of the most underreported stories in global health. Historically, smoking was overwhelmingly male in low- and middle-income countries. Cultural norms discouraged women from smoking. That's changing rapidly as those norms shift and as the tobacco industry aggressively targets women with marketing. In Indonesia, female smoking prevalence rose from 4.2% in 2010 to 6.8% in 2023. That's a 60% relative increase.
That's in a country with a huge population.
Indonesia has roughly 280 million people. A 2.6 percentage point increase among women translates to millions of new smokers. The tobacco industry markets to women there with images of modernity, independence, weight control, the same playbook they used in the United States in the 1930s and 40s.
Virginia Slims and the whole "you've come a long way, baby" thing.
Just repackaged for Jakarta and Surabaya. And the policy environment is very different. Indonesia is one of the few countries that hasn't ratified the FCTC. Tobacco advertising is still widespread. Cigarettes are cheap. And there's very little public health infrastructure for cessation.
The two big countertrends are youth in countries like Israel, where specific products evade regulation, and women in countries where the industry is still in growth mode. What about the hardcore smoker problem in countries that have otherwise succeeded?
This is the third piece of the paradox, and it's the one that's most relevant to high-income countries like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and increasingly the UK. When you've done everything right, high taxes, advertising bans, plain packaging, smoke-free laws, the smokers who remain are a different population than the smokers of 30 years ago.
More addicted, lower income, more likely to have co-occurring mental health conditions.
In Canada, smoking prevalence is around 11% nationally, but among people with serious mental illness, it's above 40%. Among Indigenous populations, it's above 30%. Among people in the lowest income quintile, it's more than double the national average. These are people for whom just quit advice is laughably inadequate.
Because the smoking isn't just a bad habit, it's self-medication, or it's embedded in a life with chronic stress and few alternatives for relief.
And the cessation tools we've developed were largely tested on middle-class, mentally healthy populations. Nicotine replacement therapy works, but it works better when you have stable housing, disposable income, and access to healthcare. The hardcore smoker population doesn't reliably have those things, so the policy challenge shifts from awareness, they know it's killing them, to addiction treatment and social support.
Which is much harder and more expensive than putting warning labels on packages.
New Zealand tried to solve this with their smoke-free generation law, banning cigarette sales to anyone born after 2008. It was world-leading legislation when it passed.
Then they walked it back.
Partially repealed in 2026. The black market grew faster than anyone anticipated. Organized crime moved in. The government lost tax revenue. And there was a genuine political backlash from people who saw it as nanny state overreach, even though the public health rationale was sound.
The black market problem is the unspoken variable in a lot of tobacco policy. Raise taxes high enough, and you create an incentive for smuggling that can completely undermine the public health goal.
It's not theoretical. In some Canadian provinces, contraband cigarettes are estimated to be 30 to 40% of the market. In the UK, illicit tobacco is about 15%. Once that infrastructure exists, the supply chains, the distribution networks, it doesn't just go away when you adjust policy. It becomes a parallel economy.
To recap the counter trends so far, youth smoking in Israel driven by water pipe and weak enforcement, rising female smoking in countries like Indonesia driven by industry marketing, and a hardcore smoker population in high-income countries that's resistant to conventional cessation tools. That's three distinct mechanisms, all hidden by the global headline number.
There's a fourth one that's even more complicated, novel nicotine products. E-cigarettes, heated tobacco, nicotine pouches. These are reshaping the landscape faster than regulators can keep up.
Let's dig into that. Are these products a solution or a new problem?
Both, depending on who you ask and which data you trust. Let's start with the case for them as a solution. Sweden has the lowest smoking rate in the European Union at 5.6%. The main reason is snus, oral tobacco pouches that have been used there for generations. Swedish men switched from cigarettes to snus in large numbers, and the result is the lowest rate of lung cancer and smoking. Related mortality in Europe.
There's a trade-off.
Oral cancer rates in Sweden are higher than the EU average. Not catastrophically higher, but measurably so. So you're trading lung cancer deaths for oral cancer cases. On net, public health experts generally agree that snus is far less harmful than smoking. Public Health England's 2025 estimate is that e-cigarettes are 95% less harmful than combustible cigarettes, but less harmful isn't the same as harmless.
The WHO is skeptical of the whole harm reduction framework.
The WHO's position is that novel nicotine products should be regulated as strictly as cigarettes, that the precautionary principle should apply, and that the industry can't be trusted, which, to be fair, has historical justification. The tobacco industry has a century-long track record of lying about health effects.
The counter-argument is that if you regulate e-cigarettes as strictly as cigarettes, you remove the incentive for smokers to switch. If the packaging is equally ugly, the tax is equally high, and the marketing equally restricted, then why would a smoker bother?
That's the tension in a nutshell, and the evidence for e-cigarettes as cessation tools has been getting stronger. The 2025 Cochrane Review, which is the gold standard for evidence synthesis, found that e-cigarettes are about 1.5 times more effective for smoking cessation than nicotine replacement therapy. People who use e-cigarettes to quit are more likely to succeed than people who use patches or gum.
The long-term health effects are unknown because they haven't been around long enough.
We have about 15 to 20 years of data on e-cigarettes versus 60-plus years on cigarettes. We know cigarettes kill. We suspect e-cigarettes are much safer, but we can't quantify the residual risk with confidence. And that uncertainty is being exploited by both sides. The industry says they're safe, the prohibitionists say they're just as bad. Neither claim is supported by evidence.
What about the youth gateway effect? That's the big fear, right? That e-cigarettes hook young people who would never have smoked, and then some of them migrate to cigarettes.
The evidence on this is mixed, and it's one of the most polarized debates in public health. There are studies showing that youth who vape are more likely to try cigarettes later. But the question is whether that's causation or correlation. Are these kids who would have smoked anyway, and vaping was just their entry point rather than the cause?
What does Japan's experience tell us?
Japan is fascinating and under-discussed. IQOS, the heated tobacco product from Philip Morris, launched there in 2014. By 2025, cigarette sales in Japan had fallen by 50%. Youth smoking rates dropped from 4.2% to 2.1% between 2020 and 2025. That's a dramatic decline.
Heated tobacco displaced cigarettes among young people, rather than recruiting new users.
That's what the data suggests. But there are concerns about dual use, people who use both IQOS and cigarettes rather than switching completely, and about whether the decline in youth smoking is sustainable or just a temporary substitution effect. We won't really know for another decade.
Japan's regulatory approach was very different from what most Western countries have done.
Japan essentially allowed heated tobacco to be marketed as a lower-risk alternative while maintaining strict controls on combustible cigarettes. It was a de facto harm reduction strategy, even though they didn't frame it that way explicitly. The result was one of the fastest declines in cigarette consumption of any developed country.
Contrast that with Finland, which took a completely different approach and also succeeded.
Finland went the prohibition route. Plain packaging, flavor bans, strict advertising restrictions, aggressive public health campaigns. Youth smoking in Finland dropped to 6% in 2024. That's down from around 15% a decade earlier. And they achieved it without embracing novel nicotine products as a harm reduction tool.
Both approaches can work. The question for Israel is which one is politically and culturally feasible.
That's where it gets sticky. Israel implemented e-cigarette regulation only in 2024, relatively late compared to the EU and North America. Waterpipe remains essentially unregulated in terms of youth access. The tax differential between cigarettes and waterpipe tobacco creates an economic incentive for young people to choose waterpipe. And the social normalization of nargila in Israeli culture. It's what you do when you go out with friends, it's part of the cafe scene, makes it resistant to the kind of denormalization campaigns that worked for cigarettes.
The waterpipe is the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It's just there, unremarkable, part of the background of social life.
And that's much harder to disrupt than a product that's already stigmatized. You can't just run a scary ad campaign about waterpipe when every 18-year-old knows 5 people who use one and seem fine. For now, yes. The latency period for waterpipe-related disease is decades. The cancers, the COPD, the cardiovascular damage, all of it takes 20 to 30 years to manifest. So the health system won't see the consequences of today's youth waterpipe use until the 2040s and 2050s.
Let's talk about the knowledge gap. Daniel mentioned that everyone except conspiracy theorists now accepts that smoking is harmful. Is that actually true globally?
It's true in high-income countries mostly. The IHME's 2025 data shows that awareness of smoking harms is above 90% in Canada, Australia, the UK, and most of Western Europe. But in parts of sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, awareness is below 50%. And even where awareness is high, specific misconceptions persist. The biggest one right now, especially among young people, is that vaping is just as harmful as smoking. The 2025 Truth Initiative study found that 40% of young smokers in the U.S. believe smoking isn't worse than vaping. That misconception actually reduces motivation to quit, because if you think they're equally harmful, why bother switching?
The public health messaging that was designed to scare people away from e-cigarettes may have accidentally convinced smokers that quitting isn't worth it.
That's the unintended consequence, and it's a serious one. When the FDI and CDC were sounding the alarm about the E-Voli outbreak in 2019, which turned out to be caused by vitamin E acetate in black market THC cartridges, not by nicotine e-cigarettes, the messaging got conflated. A lot of people came away thinking, vaping causes acute lung failure, which is not true for regulated nicotine products.
The E-Voli thing was a communication disaster.
It really was. Public health agencies were trying to warn about a specific, localized risk, and the message that reached the public was, vaping will put you in the eye, see you. By the time the cause was identified, the damage to risk perception was done.
Then there's the conspiracy theory hangover Daniel alluded to. The distrust of public health messaging in certain communities.
This has deep roots. In the United States, the tobacco industry spent decades targeting African-American communities with menthol cigarette marketing. Menthol makes the smoke smoother and easier to inhale deeply, which increases addiction potential. By the time public health agencies started pushing back, there was already a well-founded skepticism. You let them market this to us for 40 years, and now you're telling us it's dangerous?
That skepticism generalized.
And it's not irrational, given the history. The same dynamic exists in other communities that have been targeted by the industry. Low-income populations, LGBTQ communities, military veterans. When you've been treated as a market to exploit, you're not going to automatically trust the institutions that are now telling you to quit.
Secondhand smoke awareness is another area where the knowledge hasn't fully permeated. Daniel mentioned it in the prompt. What's the global picture?
The IHME data for 2025 estimates 1.2 million deaths annually from secondhand smoke exposure. That's down from about 1.5 million a decade ago, but it's still enormous. And the awareness gap is stark. In high-income countries, awareness of secondhand smoke harms is above 90%. In parts of sub-Saharan Africa, it's below 40%. In South Asia, it's around 50%.
Awareness correlates with exposure.
The places where people don't know secondhand smoke is dangerous are the places where they're most exposed to it, at home, in workplaces, in public spaces. Children in these settings are getting the equivalent of pack-a-day exposure just from ambient smoke.
That's a failure of the global public health apparatus. The FCTC has been around for 20 years, and we still have hundreds of millions of people who don't know that the smoke from someone else's cigarette can kill them.
It's a knowledge distribution problem. The science is settled. The communication channels to reach these populations don't exist or are underfunded. And in some countries, the tobacco industry actively works to suppress or muddy the message.
Let's shift to the policy question. If you're an Israeli policymaker looking at this youth smoking data, what should you do?
The evidence points to a few interventions with strong track records. Finland's flavor ban and plain packaging package reduced youth smoking by about 40% after 2020. That's the strongest evidence we have for product regulation specifically targeting youth.
Finland's intervention was aimed at e-cigarettes and conventional cigarettes. Would it work for water pipe?
Water pipe requires a different approach because it's consumed differently. You can't plain package a Nargila session at a cafe. The most effective intervention would probably be a combination of much stricter age verification at water pipe establishments, higher taxes on water pipe tobacco specifically, and a public education campaign that directly addresses the misconception that water pipe is safer than cigarettes.
Which is always the weak link.
Israel has laws on the books about indoor smoking and age restrictions, but enforcement is inconsistent at best. There was a Times of Israel piece recently about a government task force that found 8,000 deaths per year in Israel are tied to tobacco, and they specifically flagged the enforcement gap as a critical failure point.
8,000 deaths a year in a country of 9 million people. That's not a small number.
It's roughly comparable to the annual death toll from COVID at its peak, but it happens every year, year after year, and it doesn't make headlines.
Because it's slow and predictable. There's no news value in smoking kills another 8,000 Israelis this year.
It's the normalization of a slow-motion catastrophe.
What about the countries that are doing it right? You mentioned Finland and Japan. Who else should we be watching?
Sweden is the obvious harm reduction case study, with the snus caveat I mentioned. The UK has been aggressive on e-cigarettes as cessation tools. The National Health Service actually recommends them. Australia has gone the other direction, with prescription-only access to nicotine e-cigarettes, and their smoking rate is still declining, but more slowly. New Zealand was the boldest experiment, and the partial repeal is a cautionary tale about moving faster than the political consensus can sustain.
There's no single playbook. Each country's approach has to account for its specific cultural context, product mix, and political feasibility.
That's the core insight, and it's why the just do what Sweden did or just do what Finland did. Arguments miss the point. Israel has a water pipe culture that Sweden doesn't have. It has a regulatory enforcement culture that's different from Finland's. It has a geopolitical situation that consumes political attention and makes public health a lower priority.
The war does tend to crowd out everything else.
It does, and understandably so. But the 8,000 deaths a year don't pause because there's a conflict in the north.
Let's talk about the individual level. If someone listening is a smoker or knows a smoker, what does the evidence say about the best way to quit?
The 2025 update from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends combination nicotine replacement therapy as first-line treatment. That's a patch for baseline cravings, plus a fast-acting form like gum or lozenge for breakthrough cravings, combined with behavioral counseling, either in person or through a quit line. The evidence for cold turkey quitting is not strong. Most people need multiple attempts and pharmacological support.
E-cigarettes is a quitting tool?
Under medical guidance, they're a reasonable option for people who've tried NRT and failed. The Cochrane Review evidence is solid. But the key phrase is, under medical guidance. Self-experimenting with whatever vape product is available at the corner store is not the same thing as a structured cessation attempt.
Because the products vary wildly in nicotine delivery, quality control, and safety.
A regulated nicotine e-cigarette from a pharmacy is a very different product from a disposable vape with unknown nicotine concentration and unknown additives. One of the regulatory failures in many countries, including Israel until recently, is treating all of these products as the same category.
The actionable advice for an individual smoker is, use the evidence-based tools. Don't try to white-knuckle it. And if you're considering e-cigarettes, do it through a healthcare provider, not a vape shop.
That's the summary, yes. And for parents worried about their teenagers, the evidence suggests that scare tactics backfire. The vaping will kill you. Message loses credibility when the kid's friends have been vaping for 2 years and seem fine. Better to talk about addiction itself. The loss of control, the financial cost, the way nicotine reshapes the adolescent brain's reward system.
That's a harder conversation to have.
It is, but it's more honest. And teenagers have very sensitive dishonesty detectors.
What should we be watching for in the next year or two on this?
The big one is the 2026 WHO Global Tobacco Report, due in November. It will include the first comprehensive global data on novel nicotine products: e-cigarettes, heated tobacco, nicotine pouches, broken down by country and demographic. That's going to be a major inflection point for global policy.
Because right now, the data is patchy, and everyone is arguing from incomplete evidence.
The WHO report will give us a baseline. We'll be able to see which countries have high e-cigarette use, and whether it correlates with lower smoking rates or higher youth initiation. That evidence will shape the next decade of regulation.
The other thing to watch is the long-term health data on heated tobacco. Japan has had IQOS for over a decade now. The epidemiological signal should be starting to emerge.
The first cohort studies of long-term IQOS users are underway. If heated tobacco turns out to be substantially safer than cigarettes, and the toxicological data suggests it is, though not as safe as not using anything, that strengthens the harm reduction case. If unexpected harms show up, the calculus changes.
The answer to Daniel's question, has the knowledge permeated into lower rates everywhere, is a qualified no. Global rates are down, but the map is lumpy. Youth in Israel are smoking more water pipe. Women in Indonesia are taking up cigarettes. Hardcore smokers in Canada are being left behind by cessation programs. And novel nicotine products are creating a whole new landscape that the regulatory system is struggling to navigate.
The knowledge has permeated, but knowledge alone doesn't change behavior when addiction, culture, marketing, and policy all push in the other direction. The countries that have succeeded, Finland, Sweden, Japan, didn't just tell people smoking was bad, they changed the environment in which smoking decisions are made.
The countries that are struggling, Israel among them, haven't done that consistently, or have done it for cigarettes while leaving other products largely untouched.
That's the core policy failure. You can't regulate one nicotine product aggressively while ignoring another and expect youth rates to decline. Young people will find the gap in the regulatory wall.
Like water through cracks.
Exactly like that.
Alright, so given all this complexity, what can we actually take away from this? Three things seem worth pulling out.
First, for policymakers, targeted interventions beat blanket approaches. Finland's flavor ban and plain packaging worked because they targeted the products and marketing that were actually driving youth initiation. Israel's cigarette tax hike missed the mark because it didn't touch water pipe. You have to regulate the products young people are actually using, not the ones you wish they were using.
Second, for individuals, if you or someone you know is trying to quit, use the evidence. Combination NRT with counseling is the first-line recommendation. E-cigarettes under medical guidance are a reasonable second-line option. Cold turkey has a low success rate. There's no virtue in suffering through withdrawal unassisted.
Third, for the informed audience watching this space, the 2026 WHO report in November is going to be a major moment. It'll give us the first real global picture of how novel nicotine products are interacting with smoking rates. That data will either validate the harm reduction approach or strengthen the case for stricter regulation. Either way, it's going to shape policy for the next decade.
The open question that hangs over all of this, will novel nicotine products accelerate the decline of smoking, or create a new generation of nicotine addicts? The answer probably depends less on the science than on the regulatory choices countries make in the next 5 years.
The science tells us these products are substantially less harmful than smoking. What it doesn't tell us is whether we can make them available to adult smokers who want to quit without making them attractive to teenagers who would never have smoked. That's not a scientific question. It's a regulatory design question.
The countries that solve it will save millions of lives. The countries that don't will be dealing with the consequences for decades.
One last data point that puts the stakes in perspective. The 2025 Global Burden of Disease Study projects that smoking will cause 8.5 million deaths annually by 2030, up from 7.7 million in 2020. That's despite falling prevalence globally.
Because the health effects lag by decades.
The smokers who quit today won't see the mortality benefit for 10 to 20 years. The smokers who die in 2030 are mostly people who started in the 1990s and 2000s. The youth smoking rates we're seeing now in Israel and Indonesia and elsewhere. Those are the mortality statistics of the 2040s and 2050s.
The urgency is real, even if the consequences feel distant.
That's the tragedy of tobacco control. The payoff for getting it right today won't be visible for a generation, and the cost of getting it wrong is invisible until it's too late.
Check the data in your own country. Are you part of the trend or bucking it? And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1925, Italian archaeologist Roberto Paribeni discovered a single intact floor tile in the ruins of an Aksumite villa near Adulis in what is now Eritrea. The tile bears a geometric pattern of interlocking hexagons and equilateral triangles, a rare example of a trihexagonal tiling, and is the only surviving decorative element from the structure, which was otherwise reduced to rubble. Art historians believe the tiling was adapted from Coptic textile designs that reached the Aksumite kingdom through Red Sea trade routes, making it a lone architectural artifact of a cultural fusion that left almost no other physical trace.
Right. This has been my Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you got something out of this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.